As you have seen, we have trouble knowing the parameters of whichever model we assume runs the world. So with Extremistan, the problem of induction pops up again, this time even more significantly than at any previous time in this book. Simply, if a mechanism is fractal, it can deliver large values. Therefore, the incidence of large deviations is possible, but how possible, how often they should occur, will be hard to know with any precision. This is similar to the water puddle problem. Plenty of ice cubes could have generated it. As someone who goes from reality to possible explanatory models, I face a completely different spate of problems from those who do the opposite. I have just read three popular science books that summarize the research in complex systems: Mark Buchanan's Ubiquity, Philip Ball's Critical Mass, and Paul Ormerod's Why Most Things Fail. These three authors present the world of social science as full of power laws, a view with which I most certainly agree. They also claim that there is universality of many of these phenomena, that there is a wonderful similarity between various processes in nature and the behavior of social groups, which I agree with. They back their studies with the various theories on networks and show the wonderful correspondence between the so-called critical phenomena in natural science and the self-organization of social groups. They bring together processes that generate avalanches, social contagions, and what they call informational cascades, which I agree with. Universality is one of the reasons physicists find power laws associated with critical points particularly interesting. There are many situations, both in dynamical systems theory and statistical mechanics, where many of the properties of the dynamics around critical points are independent of the details of the underlying dynamical system. The exponent at the critical point may be the same for many systems in the same group, even though many other aspects of the system are different. I almost agree with this notion of universality. Finally, all three authors encourage us to apply techniques from statistical physics, avoiding econometrics and Gaussian-style non-scalable distributions like the plague, and I couldn't agree more. But all three authors, by producing or promoting precision, fall into the trap of not differentiating between the forward and the backward processes, between the problem and the inverse problem. To me, the greatest scientific and epistemological sin. They are not alone. Nearly everyone who works with data but doesn't make decisions on the basis of these data tends to be guilty of the same sin, a variation of the narrative fallacy. In the absence of a feedback process, you look at models and think that they confirm reality. I believe in the ideas of these three books, but not in the way they are being used, and certainly not with the precision the authors ascribe to them. As a matter of fact, complexity theory should make us more suspicious of scientific claims of precise models of reality. It does not make all the swans white. That is predictable. It makes them gray, and only gray. Footnote: the defense mechanism when you question their work is to say that they do science, not philosophy, and to berate my approach of worrying about model errors. This is a common trap. People think that science is about formulating predictions, even when wrong. To me, science is about how not to be a sucker. As I have said earlier, the world, epistemologically, is literally a different place to a bottom-up empiricist. We don't have the luxury of sitting down to read the equation that governs the universe. We just observe data and make an assumption about what the real process might be and calibrate by adjusting our equation in accordance with additional information. As events present themselves to us, we compare what we see to what we expected to see. It is usually a humbling process, particularly for someone aware of the narrative fallacy, to discover that history runs forward, not backward. As much as one thinks that businessmen have big egos, these people are often humbled by reminders of the differences between decision and results, between precise models and reality. What I am talking about is opacity, incompleteness of information, the invisibility of the generator of the world. History does not reveal its mind to us. We need to guess what's inside of it. From representation to reality. The preceding idea links all the parts of this book. While many study psychology, mathematics, or evolutionary theory and look for ways to take it to the bank by applying their ideas to business, I suggest the exact opposite. Study the intense, uncharted, humbling uncertainty in the markets as a means to get insights about the nature of randomness that is applicable to psychology, probability, mathematics, decision theory, and even statistical physics. You will see the sneaky manifestations of the narrative fallacy, the ludic fallacy, and the great errors of platonicity, of going from representation to reality. When I first met Mandelbrot, I asked him why an established scientist like him, who should have more valuable things to do with his life, would take an interest in such a vulgar topic as finance. I thought that finance and economics were just a place where one learned from various empirical phenomena and filled up one's bank account with FU cash before leaving for bigger and better things. Mandelbrot's answer was, data, a gold mine of data. Indeed, everyone forgets that he started in economics before moving on to physics and the geometry of nature. Working with such abundant data humbles us. It provides the intuition of the following error: traveling the road between representation and reality in the wrong direction. The problem of the circularity of statistics, which we can also call the statistical regress argument, is as follows. Say you need past data to discover whether a probability distribution is Gaussian, fractal, or something else. You will need to establish whether you have enough data to back up your claim. How do we know if we have enough data? From the probability distribution. A distribution does tell you whether you have enough data to build confidence about what you are inferring. If it is a Gaussian bell curve, then a few points will suffice. The law of large numbers once again. And how do you know if the distribution is Gaussian? Well, from the data. So we need the data to tell us what the probability distribution is, and a probability distribution to tell us how much data we need. This causes a severe regress argument. This regress does not occur if you assume beforehand that the distribution is Gaussian. It happens that, for some reason, the Gaussian yields its properties rather easily. Extremistand distributions do not do so, so selecting the Gaussian while invoking some general law appears to be convenient. The Gaussian is used as a default distribution for that very reason. As I keep repeating, assuming its application beforehand may work with a small number of fields such as crime statistics, mortality rates, matters from Mediocristan, but not for historical data of unknown attributes, and not for matters from Extremistan. Now, why aren't statisticians who work with historical data aware of this problem? First, they do not like to hear that their entire business has been canceled by the problem of induction. Second, they are not confronted with the results of their predictions in rigorous ways. As we saw with the Makrodakis competition, they are grounded in the narrative fallacy, and they do not want to hear it. Once again, beware the forecasters. Let me take the problem one step higher up. As I mentioned earlier, plenty of fashionable models attempt to explain the genesis of Extremistan. In fact, they are grouped into two broad classes, but there are occasionally more approaches. The first class includes the simple rich-get-richer, or big-get-bigger style model that is used to explain the lumping of people around cities, the market domination of Microsoft and VHS instead of Apple and Betamax, the dynamics of academic reputations, etc. The second class concerns what are generally called percolation models, which address not the behavior of the individual, but rather the terrain in which he operates. When you pour water on a porous surface, the structure of that surface matters more than does the liquid. When a grain of sand hits a pile of other grains of sand, how the terrain is organized is what determines whether there will be an avalanche. Most models, of course, attempt to be precisely predictive, not just descriptive. I find this infuriating. They are nice tools for illustrating the genesis of Extremistan, but I insist that the generator of reality does not appear to obey them closely enough to make them helpful in precise forecasting. At least to judge by anything you find in the current literature on the subject of Extremistan. Once again, we face grave calibration problems, so it would be a great idea to avoid the common mistakes made while calibrating a nonlinear process. Recall that nonlinear processes have greater degrees of freedom than linear ones, as we saw in Chapter 11, with the implication that you run a great risk of using the wrong model. Yet once in a while you run into a book or articles advocating the application of models from statistical physics to reality. Beautiful books like Philip Ball's illustrate and inform, but they should not lead to precise quantitative models. Do not take them at face value. But let us see what we can take home from these models. Once again, a happy solution. First, in assuming a scalable, I accept that an arbitrarily large number is possible. In other words, inequalities should not stop above some known maximum bound. Say that the book The Da Vinci Code sold around 60 million copies. The Bible sold about 1 billion copies, but let's ignore it and limit our analysis to lay books written by individual authors. Although we have never known a lay book to sell 200 million copies, we can consider that the possibility is not zero. It's small, but it's not zero. For every 3 Da Vinci Code-style bestsellers, there might be 1 super bestseller, and though one has not happened so far, we cannot rule it out. And for every 15 Da Vinci Codes, there will be 1 super bestseller selling, say, 500 million copies. Apply the same logic to wealth. Say the richest person on earth is worth $50 billion. There is a non-negligible probability that next year, someone with $100 billion or more will pop out of nowhere. For every 3 people with more than $50 billion, there could be one with $100 billion or more. There is a much smaller probability of there being someone with more than $200 billion, 1/3 of the previous probability, but nevertheless, not zero. There is even a minute, but not zero, probability of there being someone worth more than $500 billion. This tells me the following. I can make inferences about things that I do not see in my data, but these things should still belong to the realm of possibilities. There is an invisible bestseller out there, one that is absent from the past data that you need to account for. Recall my point in Chapter 13. It makes investment in a book or a drug better than statistics on past data might suggest, but it can make stock market losses worse than what the past shows. Wars are fractal in nature. A war that kills more people than the devastating Second World War is possible. Not likely, but not a zero probability, although such a war has never happened in the past. Second, I will introduce an illustration from nature that will help to make the point about precision. A mountain is somewhat similar to a stone. It has an affinity with a stone, a family resemblance, but it is not identical. The word to describe such resemblances is self-affine, not the precise self-similar, but Mandelbrot had trouble communicating the notion of affinity, and the term self-similar spread with its connotation of precise resemblance rather than family resemblance. As with the mountain and the stone, the distribution of wealth above $1 billion is not exactly the same as that below $1 billion, but the two distributions have affinity. Third, I said earlier that there have been plenty of papers in the world of econophysics, the application of statistical physics to social and economic phenomena, aiming at such calibration, at pulling numbers from the world of phenomena. Many try to be predictive. Alas, we are not able to predict transitions into crises or contagions. My friend Didier Sornet attempts to build predictive models, which I love, except that I cannot use them to make predictions. But please don't tell him. He might stop building them. That I can't use them as he intends does not invalidate his work. It just makes the interpretations require broad-minded thinking, unlike models in conventional economics that are fundamentally flawed. We may be able to do well with some of Sornet's phenomena, but not all. Where is the gray swan? I have written this entire book about the black swan. This is not because I am in love with the black swan. As a humanist, I hate it. I hate most of the unfairness and damage it causes. Thus, I would like to eliminate many black swans, or at least to mitigate their effects and be protected from them. Fractal randomness is a way to reduce these surprises, to make some of the swans appear possible, so to speak, to make us aware of their consequences, to make them gray. But fractal randomness does not yield precise answers. The benefits are as follows. If you know that the stock market can crash, as it did in 1987, then such an event is not a black swan. The crash of 1987 is not an outlier if you use a fractal with an exponent of 3. If you know that biotech companies can deliver a mega-blockbuster drug, bigger than all we've had so far, then it won't be a black swan, and you will not be surprised should that drug appear. Thus, Mandelbrot's fractals allow us to account for a few black swans, but not all. I said earlier that some black swans arise because we ignore sources of randomness. Others arise when we overestimate the fractal exponent. A gray swan concerns modelable extreme events. A black swan is about unknown unknowns. I sat down and discussed this with the great man, and it became, as usual, a linguistic game. In Chapter 9, I presented the distinction economists make between Knightian uncertainty, incomputable, and Knightian risk, computable. This distinction cannot be so original an idea to be absent in our vocabulary, and so we looked for it in French. Mandelbrot mentioned one of his friends and prototypical heroes, the aristocratic mathematician Marcel Paul Schützenberger, a fine erudite who, like this author, was easily bored and could not work on problems beyond their point of diminishing returns. Schützenberger insisted on the clear-cut distinction in the French language between hasard and fortuit. Hasard, from the Arabic azar, implies, like ella, dice, tractable randomness. Fortuit is my black swan, the purely accidental and unforeseen. We went to the Petit Robert dictionary. The distinction effectively exists there. Fortuit seems to correspond to my epistemic opacity. L'imprévu est non quantifiable. Hasard to the more ludic type of uncertainty that was proposed by the Chevalier de Merret in the early gambling literature. Remarkably, the Arabs may have introduced another word to the business of uncertainty, rizqa, meaning property. I repeat, Mandelbrot deals with gray swans. I deal with the black swan. So Mandelbrot domesticated many of my black swans, but not all of them. Not completely. But he shows us a glimmer of hope with his method, a way to start thinking about the problems of uncertainty. You are indeed much safer if you know where the wild animals are. Chapter 17. Locke's Madmen, or Bell Curves in the Wrong Places. Footnote. This is a simple illustration of the general point of this book in finance and economics. If you do not believe in applying the bell curve to social variables, and if, like many professionals, you are already convinced that modern financial theory is dangerous junk science, you can safely skip this chapter. What? Anyone can become president. Alfred Nobel's legacy. Those medieval days. I have in my house two studies. One real, with interesting books and literary material, the other non-literary, where I do not enjoy working, where I relegate matters prosaic and narrowly focused. In the non-literary study is a wall full of books on statistics and the history of statistics, books I never had the fortitude to burn or throw away, though I find them largely useless outside of their academic applications. Carneades, Cicero, and Fouché know a lot more about probability than all these pseudo-sophisticated volumes. I cannot use them in class because I promised myself never to teach trash, even if dying of starvation. Why can't I use them? Not one of these books deals with extremistan. Not one. The few books that do are not by statisticians but by statistical physicists. We are teaching people methods from mediocristan and turning them loose in extremistan. It is like developing a medicine for plants and applying it to humans. It is no wonder that we run the biggest risk of all. We handle matters that belong to extremistan, but treat it as if they belonged to mediocristan, as an approximation. Several hundred thousand students in business schools and social science departments from Singapore to Urbana-Champaign, as well as people in the business world, continue to study scientific methods, all grounded in the Gaussian, all embedded in the ludic fallacy. This chapter examines disasters stemming from the application of phony mathematics to social science. The real topic might be the dangers to our society brought about by the Swedish Academy that awards the Nobel Prize. Only 50 years. Let us return to the story of my business life. Look at the graph in Figure 14 of the PDF. In the last 50 years, the 10 most extreme days in the financial markets represent half the returns. 10 days in 50 years. Meanwhile, we are mired in chit-chat. Clearly, anyone who wants more than the high number of Six Sigma as proof that markets are from extremistan needs to have his head examined. Dozens of papers show the inadequacy of the Gaussian family of distributions and the scalable nature of markets. Recall that, over the years, I myself have run statistics backward and forward on 20 million pieces of data that made me despise anyone talking about markets in Gaussian terms. But people have a hard time making the leap to the consequences of this knowledge. The strangest thing is that people in business usually agree with me when they listen to me talk or hear me make my case. But when they go to the office the next day, they revert to the Gaussian tools so entrenched in their habits. Their minds are domain-dependent, so they can exercise critical thinking at a conference while not doing so in the office. Furthermore, the Gaussian tools give them numbers, which seem to be better than nothing. The resulting measure of future uncertainty satisfies our ingrained desire to simplify, even if that means squeezing into one single number matters that are too rich to be described that way. The Clerk's Betrayal. I ended Chapter 1 with the stock market crash of 1987, which allowed me to aggressively pursue my black swan idea. Right after the crash, when I stated that those using sigmas, i.e. standard deviations, as a measure of the degree of risk and randomness were charlatans, everyone agreed with me. If the world of finance were Gaussian, an episode such as the crash, more than 20 standard deviations, would take place every several billion lifetimes of the universe. Look at the height example in Chapter 15. According to the circumstances of 1987, people accepted that rare events take place and are the main source of uncertainty. They were just unwilling to give up on the Gaussian as a central measurement tool. Hey, we have nothing else. People want a number to anchor on, yet the two methods are logically incompatible. Unbeknownst to me, 1987 was not the first time the idea of the Gaussian was shown to be lunacy. Mandelbrot proposed the scalable to the economics establishment around 1960 and showed them how the Gaussian curve did not fit prices then. But after they got over their excitement, they realized that they would have to relearn their trade. One of the influential economists of the day, the late Paul Kuttner, wrote, "Mandelbrot, like Prime Minister Churchill before him, promised us not utopia, but blood, sweat, toil, and tears. If he is right, almost all our statistical tools are obsolete or meaningless." I propose two corrections to Kuttner's statement. First, I would replace almost all with all. Second, I disagree with the blood and sweat business. I find Mandelbrot's randomness considerably easier to understand than the conventional statistics. If you come fresh to the business, do not rely on the old theoretical tools, and do not have a high expectation of certainty. Anyone can become president. And now a brief history of the Nobel Prize in Economics, which was established by the Bank of Sweden in honor of Alfred Nobel, who may be, according to his family who wants the prize abolished, now rolling in his grave with disgust. An activist family member calls the prize a public relations coup by economists, aiming to put their field on a higher footing than it deserves. True, the prize has gone to some valuable thinkers, such as the empirical psychologist Daniel Kahneman and the thinking economist Friedrich Hayek. But the committee has gotten into the habit of handing out Nobel Prizes to those who bring rigor to the process with pseudoscience and phony mathematics. After the stock market crash, they rewarded two theoreticians, Harry Markowitz and William Sharpe, who built beautifully platonic models on a Gaussian base, contributing to what is called modern portfolio theory. Simply, if you remove their Gaussian assumptions and treat prices as scalable, you are left with hot air. The Nobel Committee could have tested the Sharpe and Markowitz models. They work like quack remedies sold on the internet, but nobody in Stockholm seems to have thought of it. Nor did the committee come to us practitioners to ask our opinions. Instead, it relied on an academic vetting process that, in some disciplines, can be corrupt all the way to the marrow. After that award, I made a prediction. In a world in which these two get the Nobel, anything can happen. Anyone can become president. So the Bank of Sweden and the Nobel Academy are largely responsible for giving credence to the use of the Gaussian modern portfolio theory, as institutions have founded a great cover-your-behind approach. Software vendors have sold Nobel-crowned methods for millions of dollars. How could you go wrong using it? Oddly enough, everyone in the business world initially knew that the idea was a fraud, but people get used to such methods. Alan Greenspan, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank, supposedly blurted out, "I'd rather have the opinion of a trader than a mathematician." Meanwhile, the modern portfolio theory started spreading. I will repeat the following until I am hoarse. It is contagion that determines the fate of a theory in social science, not its validity. I only realized later that Gaussian-trained finance professors were taking over business schools, and therefore MBA programs, and producing close to 100,000 students a year in the United States alone, all brainwashed by a phony portfolio theory. No empirical observation could halt the epidemic. It seemed better to teach students a theory based on the Gaussian than to teach them no theory at all. It looked more scientific than giving them what Robert C. Merton, the son of the sociologist Robert K. Merton we discussed earlier, called the anecdote. Merton wrote that before portfolio theory, finance was a collection of anecdotes, rules of thumb, and manipulation of accounting data. Portfolio theory allowed the subsequent evolution from this conceptual potpourri to a rigorous economic theory. For a sense of the degree of intellectual seriousness involved, and to compare neoclassical economics to a more honest science, consider this statement from the 19th century father of modern medicine, Claude Bernard. Facts for now, but with scientific aspirations for later. You should send economists to medical school. So the Gaussian pervaded our business and scientific cultures, and terms such as sigma, variance, standard deviation, correlation, R-square, and the eponymous Sharpe ratio, all directly linked to it, pervaded the lingo. Footnote. Granted, the Gaussian has been tinkered with, using such methods as complementary jumps, stress testing, regime switching, or the elaborate methods known as GARCH. But while these methods represent a good effort, they fail to address the bell curve's fundamental flaws. Such methods are not scale invariant. This, in my opinion, can explain the failures of sophisticated methods in real life as shown by the Makridakis competition. If you read a mutual fund prospectus or a description of a hedge fund's exposure, odds are that it will supply you, among other information, with some quantitative summary claiming to measure risk. That measure will be based on one of the above buzzwords derived from the bell curve and its kin. Today, for instance, pension funds' investment policy and choice of funds are vetted by consultants who rely on portfolio theory. If there is a problem, they can claim that they relied on standard scientific method. More horror. Things got a lot worse in 1997. The Swedish Academy gave another round of Gaussian-based Nobel Prizes to Myron Scholes and Robert C. Merton, who had improved on an old mathematical formula and made it compatible with the existing grand Gaussian general financial equilibrium theories, hence acceptable to the economics establishment. The formula was now usable. It had a list of long-forgotten precursors, among whom was the mathematician and gambler Ed Thorpe, who had authored the best-selling Beat the Dealer about how to get ahead in blackjack. But somehow people believe that Scholes and Merton invented it, when in fact they just made it acceptable. The formula was my bread and butter. Traders, bottom-up people, know its wrinkles better than academics by dint of spending their nights worrying about their risks, except that few of them could express their ideas in technical terms, so I felt I was representing them. Scholes and Merton made the formula dependent on the Gaussian, but their precursors subjected it to no such restriction. Footnote. More technically, remember my career as an option professional. Not only does an option on a very long shot benefit from black swans, but it benefits disproportionately from them, something Scholes and Merton's formula misses. The option payoff is so powerful that you do not have to be right on the odds. You can be wrong on the probability, but get a monstrously large payoff. I've called this the double bubble, the mispricing of the probability and that of the payoff. The post-crash years were entertaining for me, intellectually. I attended conferences in finance and mathematics of uncertainty. Not once did I find a speaker, Nobel or no Nobel, who understood what he was talking about when it came to probability, so I could freak them out with my questions. They did deep work in mathematics, but when you asked them where they got their probabilities, their explanations made it clear that they had fallen for the ludic fallacy. There was a strange cohabitation of technical skills and absence of understanding that you find in idiot savants. Not once did I get an intelligent answer or one that was not ad hominem. Since I was questioning their entire business, it was understandable that I drew all manner of insults: obsessive, commercial, philosophical, essayist, idle man of leisure, repetitive, practitioner. This is an insult in academia. Academic. This is an insult in business. Being on the receiving end of angry insults is not that bad. You can get quickly used to it and focus on what is not said. Pit traders are trained to handle angry rants. If you work in the chaotic pits, someone in a particularly bad mood from losing money might start cursing at you until he injures his vocal cords, then forget about it and, an hour later, invite you to his Christmas party. So you become numb to insults, particularly if you teach yourself to imagine that the person uttering them is a variant of a noisy ape with little personal control. Just keep your composure, smile, focus on analyzing the speaker, not the message, and you'll win the argument. An ad hominem attack against an intellectual, not against an idea, is highly flattering. It indicates that the person does not have anything intelligent to say about your message. The psychologist Philip Tetlock, the expert buster in Chapter 10, after listening to one of my talks, reported that he was struck by the presence of an acute state of cognitive dissonance in the audience. But how people resolve this cognitive tension, as it strikes at the core of everything they have been taught and at the methods they practice, and realize that they will continue to practice, can vary a lot. It was symptomatic that almost all people who attacked my thinking attacked a deformed version of it, like it is all random and unpredictable, rather than it is largely random, or got mixed up by showing me how the bell curve works in some physical domains. Some even had to change my biography. At a panel in Lugano, Myron Scholes once got into a state of rage and went after a transformed version of my ideas. I could see pain in his face. Once in Paris, a prominent member of the mathematical establishment, who invested part of his life on some minute sub-sub-property of the Gaussian, blew a fuse right when I showed empirical evidence of the role of black swans in markets. He turned red with anger, had difficulty breathing, and started hurling insults at me for having desecrated the institution, lacking pudeur, modesty. He shouted, "I am a member of the Academy of Science," to give more strength to his insults. The French translation of my book was out of stock the next day. My best episode was when Steve Ross, an economist perceived to be an intellectual far superior to Scholes and Merton, and deemed a formidable debater, gave a rebuttal to my ideas by signaling small errors or approximations in my presentation, such as Markowitz was not the first to, thus certifying that he had no answer to my main point. Others who had invested much of their lives in these ideas resorted to vandalism on the web. Economists often invoke a strange argument by Milton Friedman that states that models do not have to have realistic assumptions to be acceptable. giving them license to produce severely defective mathematical representations of reality. The problem, of course, is that these Gaussianizations do not have realistic assumptions and do not produce reliable results. They are neither realistic nor predictive. Also note a mental bias I encounter on the occasion. People mistake an event with a small probability, say 1 in 20 years, for a periodically occurring one. They think that they are safe if they are only exposed to it for 10 years. I had trouble getting the message about the difference between Mediocristan and Extremistan through. Many arguments presented to me were about how society has done well with the bell curve. Just look at credit bureaus, etc. The only comment I found unacceptable was, "You are right. We need you to remind us of the weakness of these methods, but you cannot throw the baby out with the bathwater," meaning that I needed to accept their reductive Gaussian distribution while also accepting that large deviations could occur. They didn't realize the incompatibility of the two approaches. It was as if one could be half dead. Not one of these users of portfolio theory in 20 years of debates explained how they could accept the Gaussian framework as well as large deviations. Not one. Confirmation. Along the way, I saw enough of the confirmation error to make Karl Popper stand up with rage. People would find data in which there were no jumps or extreme events and show me a proof that one could use the Gaussian. This was exactly like my example of the proof that O.J. Simpson is not a killer in Chapter 5. The entire statistical business confused absence of proof with proof of absence. Furthermore, people did not understand the elementary asymmetry involved. You need one single observation to reject the Gaussian, but millions of observations will not fully confirm the validity of its application. Why? Because the Gaussian bell curve disallows large deviations, but tools of Extremistan, the alternative, do not disallow long, quiet stretches. I did not know that Mandelbrot's work mattered outside aesthetics and geometry. Unlike him, I was not ostracized. I got a lot of approval from practitioners and decision-makers, though not from their research staffs. But suddenly I got the most unexpected vindication. It was just a black swan. Robert Merton Jr. and Myron Scholes were founding partners in the large speculative trading firm called Long-Term Capital Management, or LTCM, which I mentioned in Chapter 4. It was a collection of people with top-notch resumes from the highest ranks of academia. They were considered geniuses. The ideas of portfolio theory inspired their risk management of possible outcomes, thanks to their sophisticated calculations. They managed to enlarge the Ludic fallacy to industrial proportions. Then, during the summer of 1998, a combination of large events, triggered by a Russian financial crisis, took place that lay outside their models. It was a black swan. LTCM went bust and almost took down the entire financial system with it, as the exposures were massive. Since their models ruled out the possibility of large deviations, they allowed themselves to take a monstrous amount of risk. The ideas of Merton and Scholes, as well as those of modern portfolio theory, were starting to go bust. The magnitude of the losses was spectacular, too spectacular to allow us to ignore the intellectual comedy. Many friends and I thought that the portfolio theorists would suffer the fate of tobacco companies. They were endangering people's savings and would soon be brought to account for the consequences of their Gaussian-inspired methods. None of that happened. Instead, MBAs in business schools went on learning portfolio theory, and the option formula went on bearing the name Black Scholes Merton, instead of reverting to its true owners, Louis Bachelier, Ed Thorpe, and others. How to prove things. Merton the Younger is a representative of the school of neoclassical economics, which, as we have seen with LTCM, represents most powerfully the dangers of Platonified knowledge. Footnote. I am selecting Merton because I found him very illustrative of academically stamped obscurantism. I discovered Merton's shortcomings from an angry and threatening 7-page letter he sent me that gave me the impression that he was not too familiar with how we trade options, his very subject matter. He seemed to be under the impression that traders rely on rigorous economic theory, as if birds had to study bad engineering in order to fly. Looking at his methodology, I see the following pattern. He starts with rigidly Platonic assumptions, completely unrealistic, such as the Gaussian probabilities, along with many more equally disturbing ones. Then he generates theorems and proofs from these. The math is tight and elegant. The theorems are compatible with other theorems from modern portfolio theory, themselves compatible with still other theorems, building a grand theory of how people consume, save, face uncertainty, spend, and project the future. He assumes that we know the likelihood of events. The beastly word equilibrium is always present. But the whole edifice is like a game that is entirely closed, like Monopoly with all of its rules. A scholar who applies such methodology resembles Locke's definition of a madman, someone reasoning correctly from erroneous premises. Now, elegant mathematics has this property. It is perfectly right, not 99% so. This property appeals to mechanistic minds who do not want to deal with ambiguities. Unfortunately, you have to cheat somewhere to make the world fit perfect mathematics, and you have to fudge your assumptions somewhere. We have seen with the Hardy quote that professional, pure mathematicians, however, are as honest as they come. So where matters get confusing is when someone like Merton tries to be mathematical and airtight rather than focus on fitness to reality. This is where you learn from the minds of military people and those who have responsibilities in security. They do not care about perfect ludic reasoning. They want realistic ecological assumptions. In the end, they care about lives. I mentioned in Chapter 11 how those who started the game of formal thinking by manufacturing phony premises in order to generate rigorous theories were Paul Samuelson, Merton's tutor, and in the United Kingdom, John Hicks. These two wrecked the ideas of John Maynard Keynes, which they tried to formalize. Keynes was interested in uncertainty and complained about the mind-closing certainties induced by models. Other participants in the formal thinking venture were Kenneth Arrow and Gerard de Brieux. All four were Nobel'd. All four were in a delusional state under the effect of mathematics. What Dieudonné called the music of reason, and what I call Locke's madness. All of them can be safely accused of having invented an imaginary world, one that lent itself to their mathematics. The insightful scholar Martin Schubick, who held that the degree of excessive abstraction of these models, a few steps beyond necessity, makes them totally unusable, found himself ostracized, a common fate for dissenters. Footnote. Medieval medicine was also based on equilibrium ideas when it was top-down and similar to theology. Luckily, its practitioners went out of business, as they could not compete with the bottom-up surgeons, ecologically driven former barbers who gained clinical experience, and after whom Aplatonic clinical science was born. If I am alive today, it is because scholastic top-down medicine went out of business a few centuries ago. If you question what they do, as I did with Merton Jr., they will ask for tight proof. So they set the rules of the game, and you need to play by them. Coming from a practitioner background in which the principal asset is being able to work with messy but empirically acceptable mathematics, I cannot accept a pretense of science. I much prefer a sophisticated craft, focused on tricks, to a failed science looking for certainties. Or could these neoclassical model builders be doing something worse? Could it be that they are involved in what Bishop Huet calls the manufacturing of certainties? Let us see. Skeptical empiricism advocates the opposite method. I care about the premises more than the theories, and I want to minimize reliance on theories, stay light on my feet, and reduce my surprises. I want to be broadly right rather than precisely wrong. Elegance in the theories is often indicative of platonicity and weakness. It invites you to seek elegance for elegance's sake. A theory is like medicine or government, often useless, sometimes necessary, always self-serving, and on occasion lethal. So it needs to be used with care, moderation, and close adult supervision. For examples of two ways to approach randomness, please see Table 4 in the PDF. The distinction in the table between my model modern skeptical empiricist and what Samuelson's puppies represent can be generalized across disciplines. I've presented my ideas in finance because that's where I refined them. Let us now examine a category of people expected to be more thoughtful, the philosophers. Chapter 18. The Uncertainty of the Phony. Philosophers in the wrong places. Uncertainty about, mostly, lunch. What I don't care about. Education and intelligence. This final chapter of Part 3 focuses on a major ramification of the ludic fallacy, how those whose job it is to make us aware of uncertainty fail us and divert us into bogus certainties through the back door. Ludic Fallacy Redux. I have explained the ludic fallacy with the casino story, and have insisted that the sterilized randomness of games does not resemble randomness in real life. See Figure 7 in the PDF. The dice average out so quickly that I can say with certainty that the casino will beat me in the very near long run at, say, roulette, as the noise will cancel out, though not the skills. Here, the casino's advantage. The more you extend the period, or reduce the size of the bets, the more randomness, by virtue of averaging, drops out of these gambling constructs. The ludic fallacy is present in the following chance setups: random walk, dice throwing, coin flipping, the infamous digital heads or tails expressed as zero or one, Brownian motion, which corresponds to the movement of pollen particles in water, and similar examples. These setups generate a quality of randomness that does not even qualify as randomness. Proto-randomness would be a more appropriate designation. At their core, all theories built around the ludic fallacy ignore a layer of uncertainty. Worse, their proponents do not know it. One severe application of such focus on small, as opposed to large, uncertainty concerns the hackneyed greater uncertainty principle. Find the phony. The greater uncertainty principle states that in quantum physics, one cannot measure certain pairs of values with arbitrary precision, such as the position and momentum of particles. You will hit a lower bound of measurement. What you gain in the precision of one, you lose in the other. So there is an incompressible uncertainty that, in theory, will defy science and forever remain an uncertainty. This minimum uncertainty was discovered by Werner Heisenberg in 1927. I find it ludicrous to present the uncertainty principle as having anything to do with uncertainty. Why? First, this uncertainty is Gaussian. On average, it will disappear. Recall that no one person's weight will significantly change the total weight of 1,000 people. We may always remain uncertain about the future positions of small particles, but these uncertainties are very small and very numerous, and they average out. For Pluto's sake, they average out. They obey the law of large numbers we discussed in Chapter 15. Most other types of randomness do not average out. If there is one thing on this planet that is not so uncertain, it is the behavior of a collection of subatomic particles. Why? Because, as I have said earlier, when you look at an object composed of a collection of particles, the fluctuations of the particles tend to balance out. But political, social, and weather events do not have this handy property, and we patently cannot predict them. So when you hear experts presenting the problems of uncertainty in terms of subatomic particles, odds are that the expert is a phony. As a matter of fact, this may be the best way to spot a phony. I often hear people say, "Of course there are limits to our knowledge," then invoke the greater uncertainty principle as they try to explain that we cannot model everything. I have heard such types as the economist Myron Scholes say this at conferences. But I am sitting here in New York in August 2006, trying to go to my ancestral village of Amioun, Lebanon. Beirut's airport is closed owing to the conflict between Israel and the Shiite militia Hezbollah. There is no published airline schedule that will inform me when the war will end, if it ends. I can't figure out if my house will be standing, if Amiun will still be on the map. Recall that the family house was destroyed once before. I can't figure out whether the war is going to degenerate into something even more severe. Looking into the outcome of the war, with all my relatives, friends, and property exposed to it, I face true limits of knowledge. Can someone explain to me why I should care about subatomic particles that, anyway, converge to a Gaussian? People can't predict how long they will be happy with recently acquired objects, how long their marriages will last, how their new jobs will turn out. Yet it's subatomic particles that they cite as limits of prediction. They're ignoring a mammoth standing in front of them in favor of matter even a microscope would not allow them to see. Can philosophers be dangerous to society? I will go further. People who worry about pennies instead of dollars can be dangerous to society. They mean well, but, invoking my Bastiat argument of Chapter 8, they are a threat to us. They are wasting our studies of uncertainty by focusing on the insignificant. Our resources, both cognitive and scientific, are limited, perhaps too limited. Those who distract us increase the risk of black swans. This commoditization of the notion of uncertainty as symptomatic of black swan blindness is worth discussing further here. Given that people in finance and economics are seeped in the Gaussian to the point of choking on it, I looked for financial economists with philosophical bents to see how their critical thinking allows them to handle this problem. I found a few. One such person got a PhD in philosophy, then, 4 years later, another in finance. He published papers in both fields, as well as numerous textbooks in finance, but I was disheartened by him. He seemed to have compartmentalized his ideas on uncertainty so that he had two distinct professions, philosophy and quantitative finance. The problem of induction, mediocristan, epistemic opacity, or the offensive assumption of the Gaussian, these did not hit him as true problems. His numerous textbooks drilled Gaussian methods into students' heads, as though their author had forgotten that he was a philosopher. Then he promptly remembered that he was when writing philosophy texts on seemingly scholarly matters. The same context specificity leads people to take the escalator to the Stairmasters, but the philosopher's case is far, far more dangerous since he uses up our storage for critical thinking in a sterile occupation. Philosophers like to practice philosophical thinking on Me Too subjects that other philosophers call philosophy, and they leave their minds at the door when they are outside of these subjects. The problem of practice. As much as I rail against the bell curve, Platonicity, and the ludic fallacy, my principal problem is not so much with statisticians. After all, these are computing people, not thinkers. We should be far less tolerant of philosophers, with their bureaucratic apparatchiks closing our minds. Philosophers, the watchdogs of critical thinking, have duties beyond those of other professions. How many Wittgensteins can dance on the head of a pin? A number of semi-shabbily dressed, but thoughtful-looking people gather in a room, silently looking at a guest speaker. They are all professional philosophers attending the prestigious weekly colloquium at a New York area university. The speaker sits with his nose drowned in a set of typewritten pages from which he reads in a monotone voice. He is hard to follow, so I daydream a bit and lose his thread. I can vaguely tell that the discussion revolves around some philosophical debate about Martians invading your head and controlling your will, all the while preventing you from knowing it. There seem to be several theories concerning this idea, but the speaker's opinion differs from those of other writers on the subject. He spends some time showing where his research on these head-hijacking Martians is unique. After his monologue, 55 minutes of relentless reading of the typewritten material, there is a short break, then another 55 minutes of discussion about Martians planting chips and other outlandish conjectures. Wittgenstein is occasionally mentioned. You can always mention Wittgenstein, since he is vague enough to always seem relevant. Every Friday at 4 p.m., the paychecks of these philosophers will hit their respective bank accounts. a fixed proportion of their earnings, about 16% on average, will go into the stock market in the form of an automatic investment into the university's pension plan. These people are professionally employed in the business of questioning what we take for granted. They are trained to argue about the existence of gods, the definition of truth, the redness of red, the meaning of meaning, the difference between the semantic theories of truth, conceptual and non-conceptual representations. Yet they believe blindly in the stock market and in the abilities of their pension plan manager. Why do they do so? Because they accept that this is what people should do with their savings, because experts tell them so. They doubt their own senses, but not for a second do they doubt their automatic purchases in the stock market. This domain dependence of skepticism is no different from that of medical doctors, as we saw in Chapter 8. Beyond this, they may believe without question that we can predict societal events, that the gulag will toughen you a bit, that politicians know more about what is going on than their drivers, that the chairman of the Federal Reserve saved the economy, and so many such things. They may also believe that nationality matters. They always stick French, German, or American in front of a philosopher's name, as if this has something to do with anything he has to say. Spending time with these people, whose curiosity is focused on regimented on-the-shelf topics, feels stifling. Where is Popper when you need him? I hope I've sufficiently drilled home the notion that, as a practitioner, my thinking is rooted in the belief that you cannot go from books to problems, but the reverse, from problems to books. This approach incapacitates much of that career-building verbiage. A scholar should not be a library's tool for making another library, as in the joke by Daniel Dennett. Of course, what I am saying here has been said by philosophers before, at least by the real ones. The following remark is one reason I have inordinate respect for Karl Popper. It is one of the few quotations in this book that I am not attacking. The degeneration of philosophical schools, in its turn, is the consequence of the mistaken belief that one can philosophize without having been compelled to philosophize by problems outside philosophy. Genuine philosophical problems are always rooted outside philosophy, and they die if these roots decay. These roots are easily forgotten by philosophers who study philosophy instead of being forced into philosophy by the pressure of non-philosophical problems. Such thinking may explain Popper's success outside philosophy, particularly with scientists, traders, and decision-makers, as well as his relative failure inside of it. He is rarely studied by his fellow philosophers. They prefer to write essays on Wittgenstein. Also note that I do not want to be drawn into philosophical debates with my black swan idea. What I mean by Platonicity is not so metaphysical. Plenty of people have argued with me about whether I am against essentialism, i.e., things that I hold don't have a Platonic essence, if I believe that mathematics would work in an alternative universe or some such thing. Let me set the record straight. I am a no-nonsense practitioner. I am not saying that mathematics does not correspond to an objective structure of reality. My entire point is that we are, epistemologically speaking, putting the cart before the horse and, of the space of possible mathematics, risk using the wrong one and being blinded by it. I truly believe that there are some mathematics that work, but that these are not as easily within our reach as it seems to the confirmators. The Bishop and the Analyst. I am most often irritated by those who attack the bishop, but somehow fall for the securities analyst, those who exercise their skepticism against religion, but not against economists, social scientists, and phony statisticians. Using the confirmation bias, these people will tell you that religion was horrible for mankind by counting deaths from the Inquisition and various religious wars. But they will not show you how many people were killed by nationalism, social science, and political theory under Stalinism or during the Vietnam War. Even priests don't go to bishops when they feel ill. Their first stop is the doctors. But we stop by the offices of many pseudoscientists and experts without alternative. We no longer believe in papal infallibility. We seem to believe in the infallibility of the Nobel, though, as we saw in Chapter 17. easier than you think, the problem of decision under skepticism. I have said all along that there is a problem with induction and the black swan. In fact, matters are far worse. We may have no less of a problem with phony skepticism. A. I can't do anything to stop the sun from non-rising tomorrow, no matter how hard I try. B. I can't do anything about whether or not there is an afterlife. C. I can't do anything about Martians or demons taking hold of my brain. But I have plenty of ways to avoid being a sucker. It is not much more difficult than that. I conclude part three by reiterating that my antidote to black swans is precisely to be non-commoditized in my thinking. But beyond avoiding being a sucker, this attitude lends itself to a protocol of how to act, not how to think, but how to convert knowledge into action and figure out what knowledge is worth. Let us examine what to do or not do with this in the concluding section of this book. Part 4. The End. Chapter 19. Half and Half, or How to Get Even with the Black Swan. The Other Half. Remember Apelles. When missing a train can be painful. It is now time for a few last words. Half the time I am a hyper-skeptic. The other half I hold certainties and can be intransigent about them, with a very stubborn disposition. Of course I am hyper-skeptic where others, particularly those I call Bildungsphilisters, are gullible, and gullible where others seem skeptical. I am skeptical about confirmation, though only when errors are costly, not about disconfirmation. Having plenty of data will not provide confirmation, but a single instance can disconfirm. I am skeptical when I suspect wild randomness, gullible when I believe that randomness is mild. Half the time I hate black swans, the other half I love them. I like the randomness that produces the texture of life, the positive accidents, the success of Apelles the painter, the potential gifts you do not have to pay for. Few understand the beauty in the story of Apelles. In fact, most people exercise their error avoidance by repressing the Apelles in them. Half the time I am hyper-conservative in the conduct of my own affairs. The other half, I am hyper-aggressive. This may not seem exceptional, except that my conservatism applies to what others call risk-taking, and my aggressiveness to areas where others recommend caution. I worry less about small failures, more about large, potentially terminal ones. I worry far more about the promising stock market, particularly the safe blue-chip stocks, than I do about speculative ventures. The former present invisible risks, the latter offer no surprises since you know how volatile they are and can limit your downside by investing smaller amounts. I worry less about advertised and sensational risks, more about the more vicious hidden ones. I worry less about terrorism than about diabetes, less about matters people usually worry about because they are obvious worries, and more about matters that lie outside our consciousness and common discourse. I also have to confess that I do not worry a lot. I try to worry.